This is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, my friends, you know what time it is. You've locked in to your friends from beneath the mainstream, beneath the earth, beneath the terra firma, beneath the above ground world we know as, well, that pleasant daylight realm of reality. And you've joined us now in the Moravic discontinuity, the dark disquiet, the Grahamian Report. I am Micah Hanks, joined in studio by Caleb Hanks. Good evening, Caleb Hanks. How are you?
Wyatt, I am rolling.
There is no life. Now, what is it? How's that, the quote go? There's no normal life, Wyatt. Only life, right?
We were just exploring the mysteries of the Roman Church.
That's right. And, of course, the Dark Cardinal himself down here in the Dark Disquiet, Mr. Tyler Pittman. Tyler, good evening.
Good evening.
You know, when it rains, it pours. I'm still locked out of the chat room right now. Here we are going live. That's usually kind of par for the course down here. We think we get all the hadals off of our cables and get things worked out, and then I'm still, you know,
ever since that Hadle baby chewed through the cables, man.
Well, it would also probably be helpful if I weren't using a 1964 supercomputer formerly owned by the NSA here in Grahamian International Studios. That would be very helpful. We've got an intern in studio this evening just as well, Miss Abigail Shaw, who's sitting and helping out with things. It's always helpful to have a couple of people in studio helping out. Goodness, speaking of helping out, we got some emails we'll get to here in just a moment, but I want to go ahead and just tease hour two. A special investigation into the strange nature of sleep paralysis, courtesy of yours truly and his cohorts here at the Grahamian Report.
Indeed.
I'm technically on vacation this week. You know, this is how I celebrate my vacation. I hardly get any time off. No, here I am doing a live radio program on a Tuesday night, like we always do. That's true dedication, friends. And boy, I tell you, you're gonna have a hard time. No, let me put it this way: you'll be hard pressed to find people who are as dedicated to what he does as I am to what I do.
Yes,
I am. Though
you are,
I'm a pretty dedicated guy. I tell you, I also used to think I was pretty well informed until Tyler became a member of this operation, and so we got debriefed, Caleb and I, before we went to air tonight. You know, it just seems like the world is going to hell in a handbag out there, and I'm to the point where I'm actually getting legitimately concerned about all this mess in North Korea. Truly. You know, as I understand, you know, we have the what would it be, the anti-ballistic missile weaponry of our own that would be capable of taking out these ICBMs, but it's not very comforting to know that these idiots are down there saying that they're going to be launching missiles at us and setting Washington ablaze. You know, I get more and more concerned by the day. That, and then there was this story today, and it is a bit ironic. Daily Grail carried the story that, as a matter of fact, actually, the Grahamian carried this story just as well. But I love this. Drones are going to be used to hunt illegal hunters. But then again, there's also that question about the legality of using drones to hunt humans in the first place. Caleb, were you not telling me about drones that now have, like, grappling hooks and all kinds of stuff or something like this, appendages fitted to them, basically?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm just waiting to be snatched from the ground and carried off by a drone.
Yeah, you know, it's like you see Eagle Express in the Hobbit movies, you know? I'm sorry, the Lord of the Rings films. Well, it's going to be like that, except they're going to be mechanical eagles that pick your ass up and carry you off.
That's why I just run into the woods, if I could. Hopefully get them tangled in the tree limbs.
Well, you see, as these drone technologies become artificially intelligent, okay, they become self-aware, and they're fitted with night vision, thermal vision, and all this kind of stuff. You know, you're not going to be able to even hide in the woods for much longer. Heck, we won't even be safe in a cave hundreds of miles underground. We're going to be out to lunch, you know, or worse. Anyway, yes, it is becoming a nation of drones, drone antics. We could do a whole podcast just on drones these days.
Drone nation.
And I saw Disinfo had an interview with this guy. What was the guy's name? He was actually doing a whole thing about, you know, the rise of the robots and drones. So people are already, I should find out who this guy was. He'd be a great guest to have on the program. But, you know, as a matter of fact, speaking of, if you aren't a listener of Disinfo podcast, Matt Staggs had me on recently as a guest, as well as our good friend Scotty Roberts, who is right now busily promoting his new book, The Secret History of the Reptilians. We'll be having Scotty on the program very soon, along with some very special updates from the camp of Intrepid Magazine. You know, this is one of my my many endeavors that I'm involved with. And, of course, Intrepid Magazine is the official magazine of the Graalian Report, so we'll be having Scotty on not only to talk about that book, but to talk about a lot of other things just as well. But speaking of talking and having people on to talk about things, someone who has written in recently to share, he is one among many in our email section, a good friend of the program, Bill Smith. He wanted to share a few insights. We'll go ahead and hear what Bill had to say at this moment. He says, I can't believe that anyone is upset about the similarity of an actor to a political figure. You know what he's talking about, Ryan? Have you guys seen this story?
The Obama Satan.
Yes. There have been many out there in the political landscape who have been claiming that Obama was Satan already for more than 4 years. I will neither confirm nor deny that, but I'll tell you this. Apparently, History Channel has had a program called The Bible, and on this program, they've been catching some hell, for the likeness between the character that is portraying Satan.
He looked more like Mel Brooks as Yogurt and Spaceballs to me. He had that kind of metallic face.
There's a vague resemblance between this actor and Barack Obama.
He reminds me of that vampire-looking creature in the cantina scene in Star Wars.
He looks like a lot of different things, you know. I think he's just more than anything supposed to look exotic, dark, you know, somewhat sinister.
But you have to wonder if they did plan it to look like Obama. He does look strikingly similar.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think that they actually did. You know, I've got the news story here someplace. You know, I want to come back to what Bill was talking about here. Well, I might as well just go ahead and get to it now. Or do I have the story? I think our damn printer broke before we could even get that one out. So anyway, long story short, I'll tell you, because I know what happened. The producers have apparently come forward and said that this is absolute absurdity. It was in no way, shape, or form. And if anything, they've come out in support of Obama and said that they, you know, they've professed their adoration for our president. And I don't know if I'd say I adore the guy. I respect him. You know, he's under a lot of stress. You know, he is the leader of the free nation known as the United States of America. I don't agree with a lot of his policies personally, being the radical centrist that I am. I'm nothing of a political neophyte, I'll tell you that.
Only a Sith deals in absolutes.
Exactly, and therefore I plant myself firmly in the center. I don't agree with a lot of Obama's policies. And as a matter of fact, with relation to the drone issue, that's another one of the big hot buttons that's been pressed repeatedly by the news in relation to whether drones can be used to kill American citizens. I'll just tell you right now, I fundamentally have a problem with that. But Bill wrote in about this, whether or not the History Channel was trying to make a political statement casting a guy who looked vaguely like President Obama to play Satan. He says, I can't believe that anyone is upset about the similarity of an actor to a political figure. Pointing out a similar visage is commonplace in our society, and wondering if it could be a political statement is also commonplace, an activity urged, even required in some college curricula. I often wondered about the physical resemblance between the hairlines of an actress on the series The Torkelsons and that of President Clinton. But to take offense at such opinions is like saying that those are not legitimate opinions. In fact, we all have opinions, and like armpits, most of them stink in someone else's illegitimate opinion.
That's yucky.
I can't believe he talks about the show The Torkelsons.
Yes, that's a pop culture reference you're not going to be hearing about often.
Is he talking about Chucky Lee? What actor?
Which one, Bill? Bill will have to write in and share with us. Thank you so much for that, Bill. Moving right along, Roger writes, David Wilcock. You know, I always have to tell this story. The night that Scotty Roberts and I met David Wilcock at a dinner party in Pennsylvania, he showed up wearing a Versace dress jacket, like a dinner jacket, that had like a wood grain texture on it. It was the weirdest damn thing. Anyway, that was my David Wilcock story. David Wilcock writes about how our DNA has light properties as well as being material in nature. That must be the story behind the jacket. With the capability of jumping in and out of dimensions. Now, couple this with the fact that the pineal gland within our brains is in total darkness, and it has the same makeup as and is tied to our optic sensory organs, and we see much that is left to be explained about human capabilities. We are light beings, Roger writes, and perceive reality as we do by way of the brain's unique functionality. I'm ready for more understanding of these things, and we need to share that knowledge freely toward a more enlightened development as human beings. So much work yet to do, but thanks for the push with the program, guys. You're very welcome, Roger. What little bit we can contribute, we are very, very honored and grateful for. And you know who wrote us this week is actually another fellow, a past guest here on the program, Thomas Hackney, author of the ETI Grail, with a bit more synchromysticism. Thomas writes, thought I'd squeeze a word in edgewise about the Chelyabinsk DA-14 double event. He's talking about two different events. Okay, the DA-14 asteroid, and then, of course, the meteor that exploded over the Urals region in Russia. He says, did you pick up on the fact that the two asteroids were unrelated? Well, that's at least what the media was talking about. Tom says, I mean, let's see, how do two major record-breaking meteor events manage to happen on the same day? The odds of this are not only ridiculous, they're downright inarticulate. If the Russian meteor, I guess, had held together a few more seconds before exploding flash bang bolide style, a million Russians would have or could have been killed. Talk about in our face this time. As it happened, though, no one died, just 1,000 or so cut faces, which reminds me anyway of skill. I'm not sure what he's implying there, but, you know, I think it is important to point out. He asks whether the odds as to those being, you know, just a coincidence are actually favorable. I will say this. I shouldn't name him, but I have actually a couple of folks who have had involvement with aerospace, and one of them at present who is employed with NASA who have expressed the same thing to me. They are amazed at that coincidence and have wondered if indeed there couldn't be some similarity to the two, or rather a connection between those two events that extends a bit beyond the conventional explanation. But it just so happens that as an asteroid was passing very close to Earth, that a meteor exploded over Russia the same day. Maybe they aren't unrelated, but it's very difficult right now based on what the evidence seems to dictate. And what I think we've already discussed on this program, the known trajectory of the two objects, which were completely opposite of one another. I think it's very difficult to make a case for them being related to one another. The coincidence nonetheless remains, and I think it is pretty strange. Tom also says, have you heard about NASA's GRAIL mission? It stands for Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory, a spacecraft that is studying the moon. Interesting choice of acronym, don't you think? Of course, Tom wrote a book called the ETI GRAIL. What are my thoughts on this? Well, I've told you about the Russian meteor in relation to the DAL-14 asteroid. And with regard to the GRAIL mission and its possible connection to a book of a similar title, perhaps it is indeed synchronicity. Shawnee writes, I was just reading the introduction to Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule and was struck by a recollection. Just this morning, I find myself waking up in the middle of a verbal soliloquy to the empty room. I don't remember the subject matter, but to the best of my ability to monitor such a thing, it was a transitory speech that bridged my subconscious wanderings into the physical plane of wakefulness. I also recalled at that moment that this has been something of a newly recurring phenomenon for me. I believe that there were two other recent occurrences similar to this, specifically waking in the middle of a rather complex exposition. Hope this note finds you well and didn't serve as fly in the ointment of your clearly busy schedule. Continued success, sir, and keep the spirited work up. I have to tell you, often, for me, when I'm kind of in that little period between asleep and wakefulness, I experience, probably if not some of the more complex thought in relation to things that have been going on in my mind, I hear music. And it's even inspired me to write songs before. Caleb, I bet you probably had that happen too, being a musician. Are you ever in that state where you're kind of between asleep and awake and you're hearing songs and a great idea just comes to mind?
That's where all the best stuff comes from.
Really? Really? Oh, Tyler, yeah. Have you ever had that happen before?
Can't say that I have.
He had to think about that. In other words, he's filtering his thoughts again. That or you're being controlled remotely by one of those TSA drones. TSA.
I always have it happen to where I'm laying there half asleep and I hear the most awesome music ever. And then when I come slightly out of it, I can never remember exactly how it sounded. And it's a kind of a bummer.
Usually I can't, but I've actually remembered music well enough the minute I woke up that I was able to get to an instrument, commit it to at least to short-term memory, and then later record a demo. And I've actually written some songs that way. And I know, one popular example of that, other musicians have claimed to be able to do this for some time now. Paul McCartney said that he heard a song playing in his head, and that he jumped up from a near-sleep state, landed on a piano that was next to the bed, and started playing the song that I think he called Scrambled Eggs or Bacon and Eggs, something like that. And he just would play that song, that melody, over and over and over again. Well, later he went on to finally record that song. Guess what it was? It became one of the most recorded pop songs in all of history, Yesterday.
Indeed.
By the Beatles. Yeah, I always thought that was very interesting. We also got a message from Rosa. Now, we had a lot of comments and questions and emails and things from our listenership with regard to a story we only very briefly touched on last week, which has to do with Japanese survivors of the tsunami that occurred 2 years ago, utilizing the services of exorcists to assist in the apparent presence of ghosts of, well, those who didn't survive, those who were unlucky enough to have been, to have had their lives taken by this tsunami event. Obviously, it was very scary. Now, I took personal issue with the fact that Reuters had used that story as basically a springboard for talking about mental illness. And they had tried to assert, albeit vaguely, that the Japanese survivors of the tsunami were suffering from some form of mental illness because they believed they were seeing ghosts and would rather call exorcists than to admit that it was mental illness striking. I've even gotten some criticism from folks living in Japan who have said, you know, really, you should have shown more respect to the survivors. I have to say, first of all, you know, how is it disrespectful to point out the fact that the media is utilizing their claims of seeing ghosts for purposes of trying to draw attention to mental illness? We were trying to do the exact opposite, and I think that it's very important that we point out that when we're taking into consideration differences in, for instance, Western culture and the cultural values and the beliefs, spirituality, and other things in relation to another culture on another part of the world, we can't, you know, force our own ideals and our own spirituality and our own modern understanding of science and psychology and all these things in every instance onto those people's culture and values. That's what Reuters did, and so I will stand in defense of the Japanese. Sure, there may be mental illness and sometimes such things as post-traumatic stress syndrome and this and the like, you know, can certainly manifest, and I don't doubt that people from time to time claim they see ghosts as a result of actual valid mental conditions. I don't think it's safe to assert that every person in every instance who claims they've seen a ghost is suffering from a psychotic break from reality. That's essentially what Reuters did. I don't see what's disrespectful about us questioning the official Western stance on another culture's beliefs and spiritual values, okay? But that said, Rosa, one of our listeners, a regular listener, writes and says, Micah, Caleb, and Tyler, another great show this week. I'm just writing to you guys because the story of the Japanese tsunami survivors reminded me of the Hispanic culture's related illnesses known as susto and espanto. Okay, a little on the syndrome. Susto means spooked, and espanto means frightened or mortified in Spanish. Now, susto is the folklore equivalent of PTSD. After a person is greatly frightened, shocked, or even stressed, that they can often manifest a variety of symptoms, including but not limited to headaches, anxiety, anorexia, stomach problems, body aches, insomnia, but most notably, depression, OCD, and other related mental symptoms. Now, as time passes, these conditions become chronic or jump around from one thing to another. It is believed that when the person is frightened, the soul is dislodged from the body in this tradition. And that chill that a person feels when they are spooked is the soul stirring around in the body's shell. I like to think of this as a software corruption in the body, the soul being the operating system that manages the body and its functions, the computer hardware and its applications. Now, espanto happens when the terror is so much greater that these symptoms manifest in more radical life-threatening conditions such as liver diseases, diabetes, and cancer. Usually the illnesses completely manifest within 3 to 5 years of the big scare if left untreated. The reason I bring this up is because when espanto happens, it's believed that the soul is pretty much left hanging on by a thread. Some people have reported supernatural interactions, such as seeing that they what they interpret as being, get this, a ghost or spirits, or even hearing voices. This could be PTSD, but maybe the believed disconnection of the soul from the body could account for some of the supernatural encounters. Is the ungrounded soul interacting with the other side, another dimension, or even the past? Maybe the soul is neglecting its duties of mediating the body's functions because it's locked out of the body. Not unlike the Japanese approach in the article, susto and espanto is also cured by a spiritual healer performing a ritual of cleansing. They're not exactly exorcists, but some of these healers also offer that service. Cosmic love to you and all, and keep up the good work out there. Sincerely, Rosa. I think that's a very valid and insightful point because, again, there are many different cultural interpretations of the manifestations of these sorts of what you might call spiritual ailments. And Western science so often mischaracterizes these things as being, well, a psychotic break from reality. That's going to be something we'll be talking about during Hour 2, during our analysis of sleep paralysis here on The Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report with a fantastic studio staff helping keep me in line, which is obviously a very difficult thing to do here, especially in, I guess, what might effectively be international territory down here underground.
Have you heard about this new beast on the scene, the Minaha?
I don't think I want to hear about the Minaha. You know,
Tyler actually brought the Minaha to my attention, and I mean,
I think Tyler brought it to life. Tyler is actually a large, shaved Minaha. I understand it to be.
Don't speak it.
It's a truly bone-chilling tale.
The Minaha is actually a Sasquatch-like creature, correct?
Yeah, more sticks in its fur.
Oh man, did you guys see this footage of this new? Or the new footage. Actually, I did. I showed it to you last night. New footage of a Myakka skunk ape.
Indeed.
In Florida. Now, the reason they're calling this a Myakka skunk ape, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If we've got any Florida area listeners, maybe, I've always wondered if it was Myakka, I think. Maybe
Myakka.
Maybe Myakka.
Myak.
Myak. Pure Canadian Myak. Yeah. But,
out, booger lips.
We're talking about, it's not going to be people eating Brussels sprouts. It'll be Brussels sprouts eating people. That's code, for those of you who didn't pick up on it. Anyway.
Okay, we're done.
Yeah, but, there was a new video. And what's interesting is, it's a gentleman and his son who stopped by the side of the road claimed that they saw this large, dark, presumably hairy, personage walking out through a field on two legs. They had iPhones, and so they both get out and start filming with their iPhones. And what's interesting is at one point, the father who is filming, his son's in the foreground, who's also filming with his phone, the father looks to the right, and you can see that there are other people pulled off by the side of the road, off to their right, and they're too standing there with their phones out, filming, and there's one woman who's standing there with looks like a fairly nice, maybe like a Canon Rebel or, at least a fairly nice camera, okay, a 35mm digital camera. Actually, if they're digital, they're not technically 35 milli, but I come from the old school cameras where,
she had a big long lens.
Yeah, she had a telephoto lens on an SLR, camera, probably a digital model. I'd love to see what photographs she got of this thing.
And you definitely can't see too much in the iPhone video.
You can't see anything. Now, toward the end of this video that the father posted online, they post some still photos that he took with his phone camera, and he was able to zoom in. You can see a big black blur. And so a lot of folks are saying that this is compelling footage because of the way that the people who pulled off to the side of the road, to the road with them were acting. And the fact that he pans to the right at one point and that you can see all these people standing there, they say that this potentially makes it... Well, actually, Bigfoot Evidence was one of the blogs that carried this. They were the ones who said that this seemed to make the footage a little bit more compelling. Some of the commenters on the post were also talking about this. Now, the question I will pose to folks here, does it make a video truly more compelling if the video merely shows other people who are witnesses to the event, and yet the actual anomaly is no more clear than in any of these other presumed blob squatch videos? Does that actually make this story any more compelling?
I don't know. Have you ever seen people reacting that way to a bear or something like that?
I have, yeah. I mean, yeah. If anything, if a bear or a wolf or if a cougar or, even a couple of deer, we're off by this. Actually, around here, deer are fairly, commonplace. I don't think people are going to pull off to the side of the road and start taking pictures of a deer. But if there were a bear, if it were staying stationary for long enough or moving through a large, wide area where people could actually observe it for a while.
Yeah, I think it definitely could have been a bear.
Yeah, it could have been a number of different things.
Yeah.
But the point is that, again, this man and his son claimed that what they couldn't capture clearly with their camera, they were able to discern with their naked eye, and they say that what they saw was a large creature walking upright. So it would be interesting to see if the secondary witness, the woman with the telephoto lens, who obviously had to have been able to get better images of this thing, if she too managed to get photos and if she would come forward. That would just be fascinating. Check it out. We'll have that linked in the show notes for this week's edition of the podcast. Now, something else that's really... a quick shout-out, by the way, to our friends at Who Forted, who are in the chat room tonight. Greg and the guys are just really doing a fantastic job over there. I can't wait until this Planet Weird documentary that they've been working on...
I don't understand their name.
Who Forted? Well, it is kind of curious. I don't know. We'll have to get Greg
some... I wonder what they could be implying.
Greg, maybe he could fill us in at some point. I understand that there's one famous cryptozoologist who apparently unraveled the mystery. But I'm very excited about this Planet Weird documentary that the guys are putting together there at whofortedblog.com. It's not only is it going to be incredible, not only is it, I think we just got our answer in the chat room there. Yes. Not only is this going to be a fantastic documentary, I'm in it. And of course, you know, it could be nothing less than fantastic with a guy like me in the film. It goes into, as a matter of fact, a bit of the Skunk Ape lore here in the Southeast. I, of course, took them to Brown Mountain, which is really, we were joking around about the alien cave based task force. But years ago, I was told a very strange story by a former MUFON director about allegations that there actually was an underground base at Brown Mountain.
Indeed.
And furthermore, there was also a book published by our friend Tim Beckley, Mr. UFO, in the Commander X book series. As a matter of fact, you can still find this book for sale on Amazon.com. It was a book all about underground bases. And Commander X also, in his book, this is apparently some sort of a government operative that used a very shady-sounding alias, Commander X. Beckley claims he's still in touch with Commander X, but X was one of these individuals who had claimed that there was this cave base at Brown Mountain. All these different people over the years have made this assertion, and so I took Greg and Dana and Jason and, of course, who's that other guy? What's his name? Nick? The weird one? No, I'm kidding. I took all the fine folks there from Who Forwarded, the film crew, up to Brown Mountain. We spent a bit of time up there in the Linville Gorge Wilderness. It was absolutely gorgeous. Actually took them down to a cave and showed them the entrance to what some believe is a guarded entrance to an alien cave base. They've got their finger on something really good with that, and I can't wait to see. As a matter of fact, here on an upcoming episode, Greg Newkirk of Who Forwarded, I suppose that Greg would probably be a fitting spokesperson for the operation. We'll have to have him on the program, get some updates about that, and see how things are progressing. In other news, I want to touch on something. These are two entirely unrelated stories, but are very similar in their scope. And, you know, in terms of synchromysticism, this is something that Tyler picks up on a lot. You know, if you are a news junkie like he and I are, and you follow the popular news, you'll begin to notice strange tie-ins. As a matter of fact, speaking of synchromystical tie-ins between news stories, we were just talking about the Myakka Skunk Ape. Well, Lauren Coleman, who actually owns the copyright to that famous photograph of the Myakka Skunk Ape, Lauren Coleman also has a secondary blog called Twilight Language that literally focuses almost entirely on these kinds of parallels between stories in the news. It was initially called The Copycat Effect, and the blog dealt with a book that Coleman wrote. Had nothing to do with cryptozoology. It had to do with his other interests, sociology and copycat crimes. You know, you'll think about this. For instance, you'll watch the news, you'll hear about one of these terrible school shootings, and within, if not a few days, sometimes a few hours, another one happens.
Yeah.
You know, and so The Copycat Effect was a book that Lauren wrote about this. I think it's a very important book. You know, I'd love to interview Lauren sometime, not about cryptozoology, but about the sociological underpinnings that our media helps propagate in terms of, you know, violent crimes and things like this. And also, yes, synchromystical parallels between unrelated stories that are so damned uncanny sometimes that it's hard to overlook them. A couple of really bizarre ones. If nothing else, these are very entertaining in terms of the interrelationship between them, and the stories themselves are nothing but absolutely disconcerting. I'll go ahead and start with this first one. Fox News carried earlier today. The headline reads, "Two men on trial for alleged plot to kill and behead the famous singer Joss Stone." Did you guys see this?
I did not, but that's pretty interesting.
It's terrifying. Two men plotted to kidnap and behead the singer Joss Stone. This reminds me of a similar story from a few months ago. A couple of chaps decided that they wanted to kidnap and castrate Justin Bieber, the singer.
You mean that's not already been done?
No. No, apparently not. And thank God they were thwarted before this was ever carried out. But this is even more disturbing. Listen to this. The two men had wanted to kidnap and, of all things, they wanted to behead Joss Stone because of her royal connections, a court was told on Monday. Kevin Liverpool, age 35, and Junior Bradshaw, aged 32, were allegedly stopped near the singer's home with a samurai sword, hammers, and a knife.
Good Lord.
Yes. Macabre notes were found, according to prosecutors, threatening to decapitate the star, dubbed She-Devil in the Flesh by these two idiots. Others read, Jocelyn, rest in peace. Find river to dump her. Look for jewelry box. And anti-royal messages such as the Queen's system was taking, and then expletive, expletive. Stone, who has sung at several royal charity gigs and was a guest at Will and Kate's wedding, was at home when the pair were arrested. So the documents appear to... Now, of course, the arrest took place a couple of years ago, but the trial has been making headlines recently because this took place earlier this week. The documents appear to express disapproval of the royal family and the Queen. Joss Stone associates with members of the royal family from time to time. Her concerts have been attended by members of it, and she was invited to the royal wedding, said prosecutor Simon Morgan. The defendants didn't like that she made remarks about the Queen, hence she becomes a target. The documents expressed their hatred of the singer. With this arsenal of weapons, it is obvious that they were intent upon serious violence. The intended target is Joss Stone, and their intention was to not only rob, but also to kill her. So, yes, okay, their stated objective was to go in there and to decapitate this young woman. And, of course, to take all of her jewelry, to find the jewelry box and to rob her while they're there. I think that they were looking for the wrong family jewels there. Describing notes and decapitation, Morgan and the samurai sword was a very handy weapon for that purpose. Liverpool and Bradshaw began plotting their kidnap of Grammy winner Joss in January of 2011. Did they really think that they were going to find, some sort of clandestine information about the royal family, or, as I had, alluded a moment ago, actual royal heirlooms or something like that?
Because if anybody's going to have that stuff, it's going to be Joss Stone.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's just...
I don't buy the story.
Well, I keep hearing stories like this, where people are engaged in absolute absurdity. Then again, looking back, a couple of decades ago, we saw the same sort of thing with Mark David Chapman, and guys like that who literally had believed in his own mind he had assumed the identity of John Lennon, the Beatles... guitarist.
There's a huge difference between John Lennon and Joss Stone.
Well, John Lennon was something of a pop icon, really, if anything, a cultural, transcultural icon. The Beatles were really probably a phenom unlike any other that pop music has ever offered, save maybe two names, and that would be Elvis Presley and Bob Dylan. I would argue that there are very few other instances where pop singers or popular musicians have carried so much weight in terms of their influence on culture. Joss Stone, yes, she's not exactly a John Lennon, but this story is just so strange. And then there's this other our friends over at Disinfo had carried. Again, it's entirely unrelated, but it's so similar in the sense that again, if you wanted to just go kill somebody, we hear about gun crimes all the time. And granted, this also allegedly took place in the UK with Joss Stone. But the thing is that they were armed with hammers, a knife, and a samurai sword. Of all the strange things that you would use to carry out this absolutely disgusting, horrific crime...
Well, at least they weren't using guns.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing, though. Of course, granted, then there are the handgun bans. Is it handguns or is it just... I guess it's obviously handguns, but also I think some hunting rifles and the like also in the UK. Well, the other thing here, though, is that the fact that they were utilizing these strange tools, I still think that there probably would have been more efficient ways that they could have gone about it if they wanted to. Let's not speculate on that. Again, it's pretty terrifying. But... it's so strange to me because it's obviously they wanted to behead the woman. There was clearly a kind of a ritual. I think maybe if anything, a throwback to the whole, back in the old days, if somebody wasn't doing well, the proletariat rises up and what have they done? They take them down to town square and they're beheaded. So obviously there was kind of a throwback to the old style public executions that they were trying to invoke here. In other words, it was a bit of a ritual. Okay, that was being implied here. Well, get this. Then there's this story that Disinfo carried. Virginia rapper to be charged with attempting to sacrifice his friend to the Illuminati. I tell you, we couldn't make this stuff up.
To get famous?
I don't know. A Henrico County judge Thursday scheduled a two-day trial in June for an aspiring rap star who, according to a prosecutor, apparently believed that he had to sacrifice his friend to be able to reach stardom. You are my sacrifice, El Amin... His apparent, I don't know if that's his actual name or a stage name, but
pretty
he was
catchy either way.
El Amin was quoted as saying before he allegedly fired a shot toward his friend's head inside a Henrico home that was to become a music studio. Now, this guy, of course, here he's saying that he's carrying out a Illuminati killing ritual, and what does he do? He shoots at the guy. The trial will delve into the hip-hop music culture and the notion that a secret society called the Illuminati has control over the success of some performers. That's interesting. This is actually going to be brought up in court, that some musicians are actually under the influence of the Illuminati.
I blame it all on that movie, Jennifer's Body.
It was the belief that a sacrifice had to occur in order to join the Illuminati that allegedly incited El Amin. Investigators recovered more than a pound of marijuana. Oh, there it is.
They were taking pots.
It was the reefer madness. They did recover more than a pound of marijuana from the Athens Avenue home, according to the search warrant, as well as literature dealing with the Illuminati and its alleged connection to the music industry. Tyler, are you familiar with anything about this?
It sounds like a wannabe, considering the fact that his home is a 2B music studio and the sacrifice.
A virgin.
Yes,
what kind
right.
of rapper hangs out with a big dumb virgin?
Well, obviously, apparently they were wannabe musicians since, he may have thought he had to sacrifice
a virgin.
What
was his name? Alid?
I don't know, but backwards I'm sure it is Satan! Oh, isn't there actually a rapper who goes by Natas, right? Is it Natas, and therefore that's backwards is Satan, right? So, it's already been done, so they had to come up with Illuminati backwards. Somebody quick, get one of our cryptographers on that. Let's figure out what that is backwards. Oh, I know what Illuminati backwards is.
It's the Menorah!
Of course. Oh, goodness. That's absolutely terrible. Okay, well, anyway, when we come back from the break, I've got a... we're gonna wrap up a couple of more stories here this hour, and then a special feature here at the Graylian Report. We're going to be talking a good bit about sleep paralysis. I've experienced it. Caleb Hanks has experienced it. Tyler Pittman has experienced it. We'll see if Tyler will even talk about his experiences. Probably not. He's never even told me exactly what happened. I'll see if I can entice him to talk about this during hour two tonight on the Graylian Report. It is your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Check us out online at www.graylianreport.com, where we're offering daily news updates in addition to the latest from Beyond the Fringe. Stick around. We'll be back right after this with the latest about TSA agents humiliating citizens as well as real-life superheroes. And can your dog sniff out cancer? I would argue that maybe they can. We'll get to all that right after this. Stay tuned. The Outback. Andrew Nicholson's latest, Weird Australia. Real reports, uncanny creatures, strange sightings, extraordinary encounters. Weird Australia, the latest from researcher Andrew Nicholson. For more information, visit WeirdAustralia.com.
For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, your weekly... Well, it's your weekly something. You know, I know everyone takes a little something different back from it each week. I try to be a rather unconventional radio host. I don't know if you'd even call me a radio host. I mean, obviously, I'm hosting a radio program.
You're what the cool people like to call a podcaster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Apparently, this is like this, you know, it's one thing if you host a radio program, you know. You're basically an overblown airhead if you're a radio host. But if you're a podcaster, you're a clicky little cool guy who hangs up in his mom's basement and records audio, you know, every now and then does an interview, reads news stories, stuff like that. See, I'm somewhere in the middle because I'm the guy usually who's a guest on everyone else's podcast, and everyone else who listens to their favorite podcasts hear me on that show as a guest, Mysterious Universe or Disinfo Podcast, any of these, and then they find out, oh, who's this goofball Micah Hanks who talks about UFOs, he has a southern accent and talks really fast, oh, he has his own podcast, and so then they come over and start listening to our show just as well. And then they find out, you know, it's actually a pretty good show, except for the two people, I think, who've ever commented on iTunes that they didn't like it.
Too bad.
That's right. You know, one of our listeners actually wrote in recently and said, you know, Micah, I feel your plight with regard to your recent, what would we call this? Your recent run-in with the TSA. That's right. I was stopped by TSA officials, of all places, at the Asheville Regional Airport. You know, I've gone through, gosh, probably more airports around the United States than I can count. Never encountered any issues. You know, Caleb and I recently had our bags searched, I guess, at the Phoenix airport. But, you know, I mean, that was standard procedure and it was fine. It wasn't a problem.
You boys got contraband in the bags.
Well, they thought there was something. And the thing is they said the equipment we were carrying looked a little funny. That's all. They ran it back through their X-ray, you know, scanners. Everything was fine. And we were on our way. No, in Asheville, not only did they try and reject my ID, then I was screened for a mandatory, random, but mandatory pat-down. You know,
random-tory.
Then they went through all of our bags, and then they had to take apart the computers and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they literally did the entire kit and caboodle. It was the entire lunchbox plus dessert. Well, one of our listeners wrote in and said, you know, Micah, you need to get a little copy of the Constitution that's printed on a piece of metal that you can carry in your pocket. And you remove all the metal objects except that so that when you step through the scanner and they say you have a metallic object on your body, you pull that out of the pocket and tell them, here, this is the U.S. Constitution. You should read it and know my rights. But there was this story recently, and it is a bit troubling. TSA agents apparently humiliated a wounded Marine with an aggressive inspection. Okay, get this. The Washington Times carried the story. The Transportation Security Administration inspectors recently forced a wounded Marine. Get this. The guy had lost both of his legs in an IED blast. Okay, an improvised explosive device had removed both of his legs while he was in service. And he was now bound to a wheelchair. So TSA agents decide that they want to have this man remove both of his prosthetic legs at one point, and at another point to stand painfully on the legs while his wheelchair was examined. According to a complaint, a congressman is registered with the TSA.
What a low blow.
You know why they do that, though. They when they took the diaper off a 90-year-old woman in a wheelchair, they said that they wanted to make sure that terrorists were not taking advantage of their vulnerability.
Exactly. So here we again, and you know, America's most wanted, you know, public enemy number one are our former servicemen. Yeah, if you've served in a look, I'm telling you, this is exactly what. Yeah, I'm not even going to pull out the A word. You know, no, not that A word. I'm not
A
even gonna,
word.
The one that I usually use for you, Mike.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I will use the A word. Administration. I'm not going to point the finger at our administration. I'm just going to say that I'm telling you. People who are of persons of interest are often veterans of foreign wars. Why is it that you go and you fight and you risk life and limb, as this man literally did, and lost two of them? How is it that you can go and you can serve our country and then you are a suspect for potential terrorist acts when you come home? This guy should not have been put through a rigmarole. He should have been allowed through. It should be obvious that the gentleman was disabled. Okay.
I think it was obvious.
I mean, well, and he should have been, you know, I think at very least he should have been treated a bit better than that. It's one thing if they needed to, you know, inspect the prosthetic legs. It's one thing if they had to inspect the wheelchair. But, I mean, I'm sorry, they had to have him remove both prosthetic legs. And then, much as is my case, sort of similar to my case in the sense that, you know, I had to have both my ID check and then I had to have a pat down and then I had to have everything searched through. This poor gentleman is made to remove both the prosthetic legs, and then, as if that weren't enough, at a secondary checkpoint, he has to stand while they search the wheelchair as well. It's just absurd.
And you listeners may think Mike is drawing a false equivalency, comparing himself to a wounded double amputee veteran, but you don't know all the places they searched him.
Yes, I went through some. It was damaging. It was invasive.
Still a bit of a.
Actually, stretch. I'll tell you this: the pat down for me wasn't all that invasive. Honestly, it was not that bad.
I think you kind of liked it.
I joked with the guy who was doing the search. Probably thought I liked it because I was joking with him the whole time. You know, trying to make it awkward though. I'm sorry. I'm a smart aleck. But anyway, that's what the A word was. Smart aleck. But anyway,
that's the S word.
That's actually SA technically. Is there a hyphen between the two? I digress. Point is that I don't understand why a person who has searched once, then they... It's almost as though if you go through one search, a pat-down, or if they try and reject the ID, then that makes you a person of interest, and so it's almost mandatory that you'll be searched yet again. So this gentleman, because he had prosthetic legs, which were already searched, then he was made to stand up while his wheelchair was searched. Yes, of course, this gentleman obviously was probably trying to... I'm sure that they didn't think he was probably trying to exploit his vulnerabilities, but it just makes sense, I guess, in the mind of the TSA that the vulnerabilities and those who would be the least that you would suspect for being a terrorist, the least among the populace that you would suspect among being terrorists, those are the ones that are going to be the very most likely to perpetrate such a horrid and terrible act. Again, this man was a veteran, but apparently that doesn't matter. So Representative Duncan Hunter said in his letter Monday that the Marine, who is still on active duty, had showed TSA agents his military identification, so they knew who he was, and he was still forced to undergo this search. A TSA office asked the Marine to stand and walk to an alternative area despite the fact that he physically could not stand or walk on his own. I wonder if someone helped him. With numerous TSA officers sitting and unwilling to assist, according to the report, I love it. An officer then made him remove his legs and then put them back on, only to advance to a secondary screening location where he was asked again to stand. This obviously had to have been very painful. And with extraordinary difficulty, stood there while his wheelchair was examined for explosives. He also said TSA officers initially directed the Marine to the wrong line and then made him move lines. Oh my God! Whoops, sorry sir, we're going to have to bring you over here now. So they made him move lines, but again made no effort to help the man. The incident occurred at Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport last week. I don't know. I guess that probably wasn't the one that we went through. But as a group of Marines were returning to San Diego, that just makes me angry. I'm sorry. I can't help but get a little ill when I hear about that. A man who has gone and has fought and has literally risked life and limb and lost a couple. And they not only make him stand up while they search his wheelchair after having removed his legs, but put him in the wrong line and then make him move again and won't help him get from line to line. That is crap.
The thing about it is like you can take precautionary measures and search somebody, but you don't have to be... like rude to them about it and not helpful. I mean, obviously the guy doesn't have any legs.
It's absolutely absurd. Hambone in the chat room just said, I heard actually when Obamacare kicks in, you won't have to worry because you'll get your prostate exams there at the airport.
Oh, yay.
That's a good way to save them. Sorry, that was funny. I thought that was quite funny.
Well played, Hambone.
But speaking of health ailments, this one was a fascinating story to me. When Claire Guest's laboratory Daisy began to act strangely around her, she knew that something was wrong. The normally placid dog seemed anxious and unusually attentive, just the kind of behavior that she had been taught to display. At the time, Dr. Guest had been training the dog to be able to detect cancer in patients, a controversial technique, of course, that uses animals' acute sense of smell to pick up chemicals given off by tumor cells. Now, I'm sure many would claim that this is pseudoscience, but apparently there is actually some legitimacy. There have even been studies as to what and why this, rather what's happening and why it works. What she could never have known when she began the training was that the first person Daisy would diagnose would be Dr. Guest, the trainer, herself. How strange. She kept jumping up on me, she said, and one day she bumped into my chest with her nose. It was unusually sore, and there seemed to be a lump there where she had bumped her nose. I had a fine needle biopsy, but it came back clear. Well, after more unsettling behavior from Daisy, the cancer dog, Dr. Guest had a core needle biopsy and was diagnosed, get this, with breast cancer. So the first biopsy hadn't actually come back with a positive, but the dog was persistent enough to cause her to get a core needle biopsy, which led to a diagnosis of breast cancer. She underwent treatment and has since been given the all clear. Had I not had Daisy's early warning, I would have been a very poor prognosis, she said. I have my dog to thank for the fact that I'm standing here today. Isn't that incredible? Now, that was back in 2009 when the dog was just a puppy and the charity only 1 year old. Daisy is now the organization's foremost advanced cancer dog. They have several. And she's able to detect different cancers, different kinds, through smelling a patient's breath, urine, or skin, because apparently these cause subtle changes as a result of the tumor cells that are present in the patient.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
That is.
So now think about this. We're trying to utilize advanced science for purposes of being able to detect such things as cancer or the onset of other kinds of illnesses and disease. And it turns out that apparently, scientifically, it is proven that some animals are capable of detecting these things, smelling, and just like a drug dog, they can be trained to be able to find whether a person has cancer and detect it, and even detect different varieties. Now, will we be able to utilize a dog or a cat's natural ability to do that in the future and implement that in a non-biological way for better detecting cancers? Very interesting. Anywho, we'll touch on more strange news and, of course, sleep paralysis during Hour 2 this week on The Grayling Report. Stay tuned.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
That's right, I am Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. Or as the fine folks at TheAnomalist.com have begun to say, the mouth of America. God help us if I ever actually do become the mouth of America. But I am proudly the mouth of the South, claiming my own region of the continental United States, and this, of course, is the podcast that you have obviously claimed your own. Thank you for listening. It is the Grayling Report. If you'd like to help us out, if you like what you hear each week on this program, whether you be a chupacabra, a skunk ape, an alien, bisectoid, insectoid, reptilian, no matter what you are, yes, no matter what you are, you can help us out. You can visit www.grayingreport.com, and there in the middle of the top-hand portion of the page, the center portion near the top of the page, you'll see a button that says donate. You can help us out. Buy Tyler Pittman some dinner. or you can actually help us upgrade some equipment, something along those lines. And I'd also encourage you to go and find a charity outside of the Graylian Report. You know, I hope actually later this year we can get involved in some sort of a charity drive here with the program. I don't mean to come across sounding like an activist, but, you know, I think that, what's the old quote? There's nothing worse in this world, no greater evil than a man who sees wrong and does nothing about it.
Indeed.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to harp on it. I don't think that we're overtly politicizing this by pointing this out, but, you know, there's a good reason why I feature public service announcements on this program for the Wounded Warrior Project, okay? WoundedWarriorProject.org. You hear that PSA, that commercial, each week on this program. Maybe not each week, but we play it often. There's a reason why I feature that. I'm not supporting, you know, interventionism where Americans go into a country and we, you know, because I frankly am one that thinks that, you know, every international conflict that we've engaged in after the Second World War have been, well, outside the jurisdiction of the Congress, which was initially the body of government which was entitled to the act of actually declaring war. We haven't been doing that. Okay, and after the Second World War, well, things began to change. And so, yes, we do often get involved in conflicts where I think America has little or no business being involved. I try to avoid too much of the political talk on this program unless it's absolutely necessary, because really, if we don't deal with important issues on a program like this or in any other kind of a situation where we have a platform, a public platform where we are able to address issues, maybe do so in a nonpartisan way, unlike so many in the mainstream media do, if we don't engage in serious, heartfelt, topical discussion about these kinds of things, then I think that we're doing people a disservice. And I take very, much seriously, not only the things that we hear about in the news, not only do I take these very seriously, but I also think that, you know, on this program that we strive to approach these things in a nonpartisan way and in a way that maybe looks at things a bit differently from the way that the mainstream is going to do. Now, without going to extremes like Alex Jones.
Are you trying to say there's bias in mainstream media, Micah?
Certainly not. You know, and not that, you know, what Alex Jones does is bad. I think that he's a bit sensational. And I think that really there's no need for overt sensationalism. I don't think there's overt need for partisan slanting to the far right and left. I think that you can just take a calm, cool, objective look at what's going on around you and say, really, are we contributing to this or are we only making things worse?
But it's better ratings if you scare the crap out of people.
You know, I'm going to name names here. I ran into my good friend Matt Matan, okay, who is now doing independent live AM radio here in Asheville, North Carolina. And he used to be on a Clear Channel cluster here in this region that I used to also be an employee for. Matt and I met working, you know, for the corporate, you know, radio cluster there. And what I'm about to say is going to ensure that I never, you know, reach syndication with this program on that cluster, but that's okay. To hell with it. And by the way, that said, I want to thank those, you know, stations, both the terrestrial stations and the internet stations out there who do carry the Graylian Report. There are a number of them. They are growing in number. There may be another one added fairly soon. A couple more, actually. We're so thankful for people who do support alternative media like the Graylian Report. It means a lot, not only to us, but I think also to those who listen to the programs like this that touch on these subjects and that try to look at things outside the flashbang drive-by method that Mr. Limbaugh has described that the mainstream does tend to take. And this is something that's very important that I think that when you have news sources that are, you know, below the radar, so to speak, they will be able to approach things in a more, well, truly fair and balanced way. And often it's also without a lot of that vitriol. I met Matt the other day, ran into him. We began to talk about things, and he said that one of the primary reasons he left, you know, a mainstream media cluster of network stations because he was instructed as a talk radio host to belittle and make fun of the callers to make it sound more edgy and to make it sound more enthralling to the listener. And he said, I'm not going to disrespect people just to make my show sound more compelling or to, you know, to drive ratings. And he left, and that was a very honorable thing for him to do. And I'm the very same way. I would just as soon do a program, you know, for, you know, hell, 150 people on an online, you know, program like this, and, you know, to a few thousand people via podcast, rather than to go mainstream and have, you know, 15 million listeners and just be talking about bullcrap constantly, you know, just basically playing the Topic A story, you know, whatever Drudge Report carried that afternoon. you know, not that there's anything wrong with the Drudge Report. Again, here's an independent media source, frankly. It might be a bit slanted, you know. But the point is that it's an individual. That's not one of these mainstream media outlets. I think a lot of people would actually say that by virtue of the influence that he has on the mainstream, that Matt Drudge is actually, a mainstream media source, which is interesting, by the way. Also, I want to dovetail off into one more thing here. No one ever talks about this, but when we talk about Matt Drudge, the Drudge Report, okay, are you familiar with one of the original Air Force studies that predated Project Blue Book with regard to UFOs? It was called the Grudge Report.
Indeed.
If you do read drudgereport.com, I often go there looking for weird news stories, okay, for this program. And the reason why is because Matt Drudge, if there's a hot UFO story in the news, Drudge will carry it. And it's obvious that he's interested in UFOs, not only because he carries UFO stories on the on his site from time to time, but also, come on, Drudge Report. Grudge Report. It's obvious the guy is a UFO buff. I would love to interview Matt Drudge at some point. No one's ever talked to him that I know of about his interest in ufology, and it's so obvious, and yet nobody, to my knowledge, has ever pointed that out. Just throwing that out there. So anyway, but all that to say, the reason I'm bringing any of this up is because, again, this story about this TSA situation, that just really, really irks me. I have a big problem with that. Caleb and I were talking during the break as the Wounded Warrior Project advertisement was playing. It's actually a public service announcement. But, I swear sometimes I think these TSA guys, literally because of the feeling, I don't want to mischaracterize anyone, but I will say that I think that from time to time there are certain individuals who are put in a position of authority who get a sick sense of power off of knowing that they have control over what an individual is able, or in the case of a disabled veteran, unable to do. And I think that they, they're sitting back there watching all this, and I think that at times there's some people who literally get a sick thrill out of watching something like that. I'll never mischaracterize an individual. I'll never speak, and talk about throwing a blanket over an entire section of the populace, those people who are actually employed under the Transportation Security Administration. But when you hear a story that is so troubling as this Washington Times story is about this humiliated, wounded Marine who had to go through multiple inspection points and have his wheelchair searched after being moved from line to line and was given no assistance, even though he's obviously painfully disabled, that just makes me absolutely sick. Okay.
Get used to it, slave.
Well, apparently I'm gonna have to get used to it, because things aren't changing, and if anything, they're only getting worse. That said, off the soapbox, the topic of discussion tonight, sleep paralysis. I think this is something that probably a startling number of Americans and people worldwide have all experienced. Fewer in number are those who come forward and talk about their experiences. Well, tonight on Graylian X, I will be, for one, talking about my own experiences with sleep paralysis. And as for the gentleman in studio with me, whom I know each of you have actually had this yourselves and experienced this like a lot of people out there, whether you two will come forward and talk about your experiences, that is yet to be seen. But I know, Caleb, you specifically have had a very interesting encounter of your own that involved sleep paralysis. You're right?
I have indeed. It actually was one of these strange synchronistic happenings I've ever had, so I don't mind talking about it at all.
Okay, well, we'll come back around to that here in a while. Now, on the other hand, Caleb has experienced something that was highly synchronistic. I wouldn't say that there's anything paranormal by definition about my own sleep paralysis experiences. And for those who are not familiar with sleep paralysis out there, we will be talking more about not only the cultural beliefs as to what causes a person to awake from a sleeping state, they find themselves unable to move, and they often experience strange auditory and visual hallucinations. We'll not only talk about what physically may be occurring that causes this, but also the strange and often what many assert to be paranormal elements that are involved. Caleb, you've had a very synchronistic experience. My own experiences have been rather mundane, and I chalk it all up just to the happenings of the dreaming mind. Tyler Pittman, not to put you on the spot, I know that you've had an experience that you would say, if anything, would almost border on the demonic.
Your interpretation frightens me.
Well, your description frightens me. Now, I'm not going to hold you to it that you have to talk about that later. I guess it's yet to be seen whether Tyler can reach into the depths of his own soul and discuss what very well may have been a demonic encounter that he had.
Yes, we will have to see.
We'll have to see how he feels about that later. And sleep paralysis is something that's always fascinated me. In my book, Magic Mysticism and the Molecule, I talked about it. I interviewed Dr. David Hufford, PhD, who is an expert on not only the cultural experience from culture to culture and world group and country to country, He also looks into the misunderstood elements of the experience and actually the pathophysiology of what's going on, what underlying the actual experience of waking up and thinking that you're seeing ghosts or demons or aliens in the room, what is actually happening within the body. Now, what's funny is that this is somewhat sort of, I guess, pseudo-recognized as a condition. What Hufford found so disturbing about it is that although it is clearly some function of the body as one is waking, well, actually, more specifically, what's actually happening here, okay, in terms of understanding sleep paralysis, it is defined as a variety of, get this, parasomnia that results from an inappropriate overlap of the REM and waking stages of sleep. It has been found that certain people who suffer from alleged bouts with sleep paralysis have had shorter REM sleep latencies than normal, along with shortened NREM and REM sleep cycles. A fragmentation, okay, of different sleep cycles, essentially. And what seems to happen is that as a person is coming out of one actual sleep cycle, once someone's waking up, part of their body is still producing a chemical that prevents them from being able to move around. And so they're lying there. Your body is telling itself you're asleep. Your mind is waking up. Your eyes open. You're able to see into the room around you. And you're able to experience what, for lack of a better term, is still a dream that overlaps with your physical environment. You know, one of our correspondents on the program, Red Pill Junkie, recently emailed me about this, and he had said one of his own recent sleep paralysis experiences was probably both one of the most interesting but also one of the most terrifying. He had dreamt that he had been seeing, I think, what were large lizards, Komodo dragons, or something like that, and he professes to being very uncomfortable with lizards, okay, creatures like Komodo dragons and the like. And anyways, he's having this dream. He says that there was, I think, a large pit or something along those lines, and there's several of these creatures in the pit. And as he's coming out of the dream, he experienced a momentary vision where, as he looked up, and he said this is very interesting, he looked up over onto the dresser where he keeps his clothes, and there was one of the lizards that was obviously still a dream, but it was overlapping with his reality, and it caught him off guard enough so that he actually was frightened and jumped up, and then, of course, it was gone. It was just a dream that was overlapping with his reality. So many people describe having these experiences. I have had my own experience with sleep paralysis just as well. As a matter of fact, probably on about three or four occasions in my life. The first time, it was Christmas Day. I was probably 17 or 18 years old. One of the neighborhood kids had come up and everything, and we were really into ninjutsu. And so we were showing each other our ninja costumes and whatever, you know. And, you know, because, you know, I used to study martial arts. Caleb and I, that was something we did a lot when we were kids. And so we were
all of which I've forgotten now.
Yeah. You know, I used to be fascinated. Bruce Lee just was really into all that stuff. And so I was a teenager, and we were going over all the nunchakus and all this different stuff. And I remember watching a television show. Okay. I think probably there was Chinese food involved here too, because on Christmas Day there's only one restaurant that stays open, you know, the Chinese restaurant. And so we'd gone down there and gotten takeout, and we were sitting there watching television, and I drifted off there on the couch, and when I woke up, I remember I'd been having a strange dream where I was hearing this odd-sounding noise, and the noise seemed to be whispering some sort of a weird something to me. It was really strange. I wake up from the dream, and I literally am still hearing this. It was like it sounded like something whispering in my ear, and I was thinking, what in the world?
Someone's in your house.
Yeah, I mean, it was creepy. I mean, I felt like somebody was trying to, you know, give me some sort of a message or something, and it was really strange feeling. And so I wake up, I'm still hearing this, and I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? And then I realize I can't move my body. Now, fortunately, here's how I'd learned about sleep paralysis. There was an article in Fate magazine. You know, Fate's whole thing for years and years has always been that they feature, you know, true stories from the readers. Readers can share their own strange experiences. And I'd read this story about a guy who had claimed that he had woken up like this one night, and he was unable to move. And he said that there was, like, he could never see it, but he heard this little and in his mind he saw a leprechaun or a goblin or something walking across the room, and it goes under the bed, and he says that he could feel
like the thing moving the bed underneath him as it walked under the bed, and he was terrified of this leprechaun thing in the room with him. And so he initially thought that it was a dream, but when he realized he was wide awake but couldn't move his body, he perceived this as being a demonic presence. And so he said he looked down at his finger on his right hand, and he began to move just the tip of his finger, and then he began to move his entire finger, and then before long he could move his entire hand and then his forearm, and at that point he snapped out of it and woke up. And he said that the minute that he snapped out of the sleep state, if you will, that he all of a sudden was alone in the room, and that the little goblin creature had gone away. Now, he didn't liken this to being sleep paralysis, but I was intrigued enough by that story that I read into it a bit more, and come to find out this was a classic sleep paralysis episode. And so when I'm sitting there on the couch, half asleep, and I'm hearing this weird whispering in my ear, I start doing the finger. I move the finger, and then I move the...
Gave the leprechaun the finger.
I gave the leprechaun the forefinger, and then the hand, and then the arm, and then...
I smell right, Mr. Torrance.
Yeah, I was about to say, all you have to do to cure yourself of one really bad movie monster is wiggle your finger at it.
Yeah, right. So I snap out of it and everything, and at that moment, when I snapped out of it and I woke up, I was looking around the room, and the noise that I'd been hearing, that my mind had been interpreting as whispering, was actually my buddy, Daryl. He's sitting over there on the couch, and he was asleep too, and he had been kind of, you know, snoring, I guess, and it was funny because my ear, in a sleep state, had been interpreting him sitting on the other side of the room, you know, snoring on the couch, as being this odd whispering. So, I mean, again, there was nothing paranormal or strange for me about it, aside from the fact that I was blatantly aware that my mind was interpreting my environment as though you might interpret things while in a dream.
So no leprechaun for you then?
I didn't get any leprechauns. I didn't get anything cool like that.
Did that upset you?
I was more upset by the fact that I didn't have anything otherworldly or paranormal happen. I just had, you know, a sleep paralysis experience. And most of my experiences, you know, since then, I think I've had it maybe one or two times after that. They've been pretty mundane. But there was one that was just a little bit more disconcerting. And this is the one that was really weird. This one happened only about a year ago. I woke up in my room, and I just remember it was a summer morning. It was kind of bleak and just nasty looking outside. You know, it just Tyler's going to act it out for us over here. But, I mean, it just looked, you know, it was just a nasty, rainy day outside. And as I woke up, I remember, for whatever reason, being aware of, this is so wonderful to wake up and have this happening. Linda Blair, in her full exorcist glory, is lying in the floor writhing.
Oh, man.
Yeah, this really happened. And so I'm thinking, oh, boy. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what a great thing to wake up to and experience, you know, during a sleep paralysis episode. And the fact that I'm so aware of what's happening to me is why, yes, you know, I realize the dreaming mind is doing, you know, amazing things to one's perception. And while this is all happening, as I'm waking up from the dream, I'm literally laying there trying to make myself snap out of it and wake up and everything. And I'm hearing this mantra, or saying it to myself in my head, the messenger or the method is the messenger, or the mayhem is the messenger, something like that. There's this mantra that was switching around method and mayhem and messenger. Anyway, and then I woke
methods
up.
Methods of mayhem?
Methods of mayhem are the messenger.
Recite a Tommy Lee Jones band as the exorcist does a flash dance.
That's right. So I come out of it and everything, and I remember after that one just waking up feeling kind of icky, you know. And now a spiritualist might listen to you telling that story and say, you had a full-on demonic encounter. Now, I don't know that that would be on par with Tyler's demonic encounter. But, Caleb, you had... Again, I don't think that there's any overt meaning that can be attributed to my experiences. Your experience with sleep paralysis was a little bit more interesting and maybe a little more meaningful. And I think, you know, what I'd like to get into with you here in just a moment is... I'd like to talk just a touch about that experience and the potential that synchronicities and mystical experiences that do actually impart wisdom or knowledge or something along those lines to us during the sleep paralysis experience. Could that kind of a thing actually transpire while one's experiencing the night hag phenomenon? It's well known throughout parts of the world, and we're going to be probing deeper into the mysteries of sleep paralysis. Tonight, I'm Micah Hanks. Back after this. We'll be right back.
moving in with a single guy. At first, I thought it might be a little weird, but turns out it's actually pretty amusing. For instance, like my human's gotten so used to me being around, sometimes I think he forgets I'm here. He'll get up for work, shower, shave, and come out with no pants. Plops right down in front of the TV. Hello, there's a lady in the room.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
The weird, the unusual, the outback. Andrew Nicholson's latest, Weird Australia. Real reports, uncanny creatures, strange sightings, extraordinary encounters. Weird Australia, the latest from researcher Andrew Nicholson. For more information, visit WeirdAustralia.com.
We're talking about sleep paralysis tonight. That's the subject on the table. And before we went to break, we were talking about a couple of my own personal experiences. I don't know that there's a whole lot to my own. I like to be able to just say that I have experienced it, though. And for people who have actually had more frightening encounters with sleep paralysis, I can at least relate to them. And I think that I understand physically that there is something happening here. But there are those who would assert that there might be a little more to this phenomena than just imagining that you are, or rather, maybe literally just dreaming and thinking that you're awake. I think that that's the first thing that people would try and assert who have no real understanding or even a desire to try and understand what's happening to a sleep paralysis experiencer. Dr. David Hufford, who I interviewed for the book Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, had talked about his own experience while he was in college and had talked about the fact that he had, when he dug into the literature about this, found out that many people who were experiencers would go and when speaking to their doctors about having had this experience, they would be told that they had suffered maybe what would, I guess, qualify for being a mild, whatever, for whatever case, a sudden psychotic break from reality, and in an instantaneous way that, you know, this just kind of erupts out of nowhere. They experience it. It never happens again, and they don't know why or how became a sufferer suddenly of this psychotic episode. And so they're given drugs and medication for something where, in truth, there's probably not a lot of grounds for there being any kind of necessity for medication, let alone the belief that they are suffering a psychotic episode. We'll get to Dr. Hufford's experience with sleep paralysis here after a bit, but first I'd like to go to you, Caleb, because we'd just gotten around to talking about your own experience. You've had this happen once or twice, maybe?
Yeah. Actually, I just recently recalled I'd gone on a trip across the country with a couple of friends of mine, and when we were staying in a hotel, I believe somewhere in Texas, I'd had this kind of waking dream where I even was like waking up, and as I sat up in my bed, in the dream I was being surrounded by like eggs that little birds were hatching out of, and I remember waking up and looking at the bed sheet. And the bed sheet was moving in my mind like the birds were in the bed. I mean, it was obviously part of the dream or the hallucination, whatever it was, in this half-awake state. But that wasn't necessarily a typical waking dream kind of scenario because I wasn't paralyzed. But I remember I jumped out of the bed and actually woke my friend up and, you know, caused a little bit of confusion there because he was like, you know, what are you doing? But the second instance that I had...
And actually, before you get into that, let me ask you something real quick. And just a yes or no answer would do just fine. Was your friend's name Justin?
Yes, it was.
Ah, because if it's the same gentleman that we know, we won't give his last name, but this is a mutual friend of yours and mine who also had a frightening sleep paralysis experience.
Yeah.
And he actually did give me permission to recount that in the book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. I think that one might be worth talking about here in a moment as well. But first, let's come back to number two, your second experience.
Indeed. The one I'm talking about now actually happened years prior to the bed bird incident.
Curse of the bed birds.
I had a really bad case of the bed birds. But,
I thought bed bugs were bad. Wait till you've got bed birds pecking on you.
Well, you know,
Tweet about it.
I do. I need to tweet about it. Actually, I wanted to bring that back real quick before we go into the other story, because it makes me wonder about the subconscious element that might be kind of projecting these images in your mind. Because I know when I was younger, I know this might sound kind of silly, but I had a somewhat traumatizing experience with a bird because I was I was crawling up in this tree, and I got up and looked in this bird house because I knew there was like baby birds in there, and the mom bird just flew out right in my face.
Oh yeah.
And I remember like being a little kid, it scared the crap out of me, and so I jumped down and just was screaming hysterically. But you know,
like a little girl.
Yeah, like I was screaming like a little girl.
Over a bed.
Well, no. It makes me wonder if somehow I wasn't bird scarred and that came out. But okay, anyway.
Tales of the bird scar.
The bird
scar. One flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Attacked by bed birds.
You guys are making this worse for me.
Caleb, we need to be able to liberate you of the engram.
We must free you of the burden.
He went there.
Well done. All right. So, getting on to tale number two.
Tale number two.
There was some somewhat interesting elements with this one, I suppose. I was at a friend's house, and he and his family had both said that there was somewhat ghostly activity that had gone on in this house for a while. I never saw anything or heard anything, but apparently the house had burned down before, and there was a death in the house, and it had been rebuilt. Anyway, there was one particular night when I was staying over there, and in the middle of the night, I wake up, can't move. I'm not having any sort of hallucinations or anything like that, but I can't move my body at all. I'm looking around. I'm freaked out because I'm paralyzed. And as I start to move, like my chest, my solar plexus, to try to kind of just move anything and get out of it. But as I broke out of this paralyzed state, I literally started having a seizure, and this is the only time in my life that I've ever had any sort of weird physical seizure activity or anything like that ever. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty alarming to me. And as I had this, started like convulsing and having this seizure, it finally broke me of the paralysis, and I was able to move again. And I was like, you know, sweating, like, what the heck happened?
See, I wonder though if that was by definition, a real seizure, or if it was something you would liken to being a seizure as you're coming out of the sleep paralysis state.
Well, I've never previously had a seizure or afterwards had a seizure or anything like that.
Right.
And it was only, I've never experienced a legitimate seizure, so I don't know if that's what that was. It just felt like my whole body was uncontrollably shaking, and it was only for a few seconds until I finally broke out of it. And the weird kind of synchronistic, bizarre aspect of this also was my friend's mom the next morning at the breakfast table said, you know, I had a dream last night that one of you guys had a seizure in there.
And my gosh.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, that is really weird.
And what did you tell her?
Yeah, I told her all about it, and I told her that I'd never had a seizure before, but I told her kind of like of my experience of the waking dream scenario, whatever had happened, and it was just so weird.
So your actual sleep paralysis experience, you say, ended in what you would liken to being a seizure, and that at the breakfast table the next morning, your friend's mother says she dreamt that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Sort of weird psychic connection, I don't know.
Yeah, see, that would, you know, again, what would you call that? A synchronicity? A coincidence? You know, some would argue that there are no coincidences. That's one of those unique circumstances.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre.
On a side note, I have to point out also, you've had similar instances where you were dreaming, or what you might call lucid dreaming, right? And you had been aware of things that were going on elsewhere in the dream state that you found out were accurate too, correct?
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about those as well?
Yeah, if you want to. I mean, I thought that was interesting, though, because you, Caleb, are one of those people who have, you know, a lot of those sorts of experiences.
Yeah, it's very strange. The only kind of weird cognitive phenomena that I experience myself always seems to happen in a dream. It's very weird. In fact, just the other day, I was having a dream about a friend of mine who I don't really correspond with that much, but I had a dream that I was somewhere with him, and then I get a text message from him as soon as I wake up.
Oh,
you know,
really?
Something weird like that. But one of the weirdest kind of seeing time or something outside of my cognitive abilities was I had this dream. I had been at a friend's house the night before and came back to my parents' house to take a nap later in the day. And so I lay down, start having this lucid dream, which I have lucid dreams pretty frequently. But I had this lucid dream that
would
I
would you define lucid dream, please?
I don't know about like a definition on the internet or in the dictionary,
sure.
But my definition is just being aware that you're dreaming or just being in an extremely real dream state to where you can't always differentiate it from real life. I mean, it is like you are right there in it, living
mm-hmm.
it.
Okay.
Unlike some dreams that are kind of fuzzy and you remember patches here and there, but these are very real. I've gotten to the point to where I can realize that I'm lucid dreaming very quickly because I sleep really, really odd hours and I'll nap pretty frequently throughout the day sometimes because I stay up all night every once in a while. And so it seems to be when you nap or sleep in sporadic bursts that these lucid dreams seem to be more, more abundant.
Hmm.
But I'll get into these dream states and start to realize like, you know, it's actually a dream, and I can even get to the point where I can manipulate the dreams to my will sometimes, which is pretty intense.
Huh.
Anyway, getting to the story, I had this dream that I was laying in front of my bedroom door, and diagonally to the left of that is the basement door, and in the dream, a mouse comes out from underneath the basement door, and I'm like hanging out with it, you know, interacting with this little mouse. And then my parents have this giant, fat, orange cat that came up and was hanging out with me and the mouse. So, in the dream, I realize it's a lucid dream, and I say, well, I'm going to try to manipulate something. And I tried, the first thing that came to mind was like a flock of butterflies. I don't know why. I wanted to turn the mouse into a flock of butterflies. Well, I didn't quite achieve this. I turned it into this kind of fat, purple, winged mouse thing, and I was like, good enough. That works. Why not?
Pretty close.
You know, yeah. It's hip, hip, hooray for pretty close. So, did that, and then the fat, slobbish kitty eats the purple mouse, the mouser fly, and I was upset with him, so I said, well, let's see if I can destroy his will. Melt the cat with my mind like he's candle wax in the dream. I don't know why these things happen. It's kind of very bizarre instances. Okay, here's the strange kind of tie-in. Wake up about an hour later, go in, and one of the first things my mom says to me is, yeah, the cat was trying to kill a mouse out in front of your bedroom door this morning.
Huh.
And the weird thing was, is what I wasn't even at the house when this occurrence happened. And I'm wondering if my mind was just in some sort of heightened state for some reason to where I saw time differently. If it was merely a coincidence that I would have a dream like that, or if I was picking up on these entities being in the house or something like that. I'm not too sure how that was. For all we know, really bizarre coincidence, but it does lead me to wonder, with something so specific of an instance,
mm-hmm.
why would I so, you know, vividly experience this in the place that this same occurrence actually happened
yeah.
in the dream? You know what I mean?
Right, absolutely. Have you had anything, obviously that was a while back, have you had anything more recent that's occurred along those lines, or do you still have those kinds of experiences?
Nothing ever that intense and nothing ever that synchronistic. That was actually kind of an interesting experience in its own because that was one of the first few nights that I started pondering about some of the ideas of singularity. And I think that my mind was really just kind of overflowing with information about the potentials of humans merging with technology. And it was just kind of blowing my mind. And it makes me think that maybe because my mind was at this heightened state of just so much information going through my head that maybe it allowed me to see momentarily when my mind was just like not really concentrating on anything in a conscious state, if it was picking up on time differently.
I've always been interested in people who start expanding their mind and thinking more abstractly, and then they start experiencing weird phenomena. Some of them begin experiencing strange synchronicities, and then it just goes, full-on psychosis, like John Nash. Remember A Beautiful Mind?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but John Nash, of course, said that he felt that the periods during which he was suffering from, you know, the strong hallucinations, that those were the absolutely most creative periods of his entire life just as well, and that he felt like when he learned to cope with the hallucinations, that it actually kind of, it took away, in a sense, from his natural creative abilities. So, you know, there seems to be a very strong correlation in some capacity between, you know, the dream state, and then the fertile mind, and of course psychic abilities, synchronicities, coincidences, and meaningful coincidences specifically. You know, all these sorts of things seem to be kind of interrelated. See, I'm not a person who has psychic dreams. I certainly have gotten impressions and premonitions of things, you know, couldn't control it or make that happen. But throughout my life, I've had a few instances where something like that's happened to me. I couldn't tell you what that connection is, but it just seems that people who are creative, and especially people who are really thinking outside the box, they'll either begin to experience, you know, in my case, something like a sleep paralysis, which is just, again, something that happens, or in your case, people who experience lucid dreams and things that actually seem to bear some semblance of meaning to the goings-on in the waking world. Which brings us now around to Tyler. I don't want to be so bold as to presume that you're actually going to talk about this, but I know for a fact you've had a revelatory and frightening experience with sleep paralysis. Is it something that you would share with the listeners?
Ah, indeed you are wise, Micah, but not wise enough to know that such a topic will not be discussed this evening.
Oh, yeah? So tell me, what is the nature of your own experience with sleep paralysis?
Is natural?
Is this a truth that we can know?
Way to hold out.
In time.
In time. Will we know it this evening?
Likely not.
See, I was right, wasn't I?
Well, I'm glad you hired a magic 8-ball.
Tyler, the magic 8-ball, the dark cardinal. Well, it's all that. Well, you know what? I'm going to continue to probe ever deeper.
Gently, please.
Ever more deeply with Tyler Pittman to try and get him to come forward with his... Well, let me ask you this. If you won't talk about your own experience, and all kidding aside, I have talked with you enough about that aside from what we're discussing right now to know that it was a very disturbing experience. But would you tell me your general feeling about the nature of sleep paralysis on the whole? I mean, do you think that sleep paralysis in general is something... do you think it's metaphysical? Do you think it's entirely a scientific, or rather a medical condition that can be explained scientifically? What are your feelings about it?
I definitely believe what they call sleep paralysis is a real medical or physiological phenomenon. I think that the term itself is probably used to make sense of something that could lie outside of what we understand right now with modern science. It's definitely interesting, and I'm sure we will see more research into this area. And anyone having experienced it myself, and I'm sure anyone who has experienced it would agree that it can be frightening, but, yeah, you know, knowing where to, and I guess understanding how to interpret such an experience, you know, either way, an encounter with something beyond our dimension, our perception, something divine or prophetic, or perhaps just a bad dream that has you encased in a icicle-like stance, you know, paralyzed with fear. Or the interesting thing is I've never heard, in all seriousness, I've never heard of a case of sleep paralysis that involved some sort of enjoyable experience or a dream like of ecstasy, and you were frozen because of whatever emotions or psychological stuff's going on when the brain is activated in that way.
Yes, a good point. Most often the experience is negative. Now, with that, I want to digress for a moment. We've shared our own experiences. We've talked generally about it. We've gone very little into the actual medical condition underlying sleep paralysis.
I have a testimony that I'm going to share now on the program from an anonymous experiencer who allowed me to record a conversation he and I had about not only his own personal experiences with sleep paralysis, but the sexual parallels that people, many if not the majority of people, generally in their 20s, their early 20s, seem to discuss, the folkloric parallel between those sexual experiences and succubi and incubi experiences, and then finally, not succubuses and incubuses, by the way, and then finally, what drove him to research this himself professionally. I cannot give this individual's name, but as an anonymous experiencer of sleep paralysis, here's what he had to share.
Sleep paralysis is a medical condition known to affect especially young adults in their 20s. Now, I say condition, you know, not disease, because it's so common that it can't be strictly considered an illness or a psychological disturbance. Some medical and psychology experts feel that it's probably a universal phenomenon experienced by all adults at some point in their lives, and probably multiple times. It occurs in the usually in the twilight state, just before waking, when you're partially awake but not fully aware of your surroundings, and so you're still not awake enough to exercise conscious control and command over your body's movements. In this way, one is paralyzed in a sort of a semi-sleep or semi-conscious state. During an event or a case of sleep paralysis, you usually feel a vivid presence of a threatening entity. Reports, you know, of the presence of imp-like creatures about 20 to 30 pounds in weight and maybe 2 feet in height is pretty common. And you feel helpless in the presence of the entity or entities, powerless, like a person subjected to rape or some other form of sexual assault is a common component in this experience. The fact is that many who suffer, not disease, but dis-ease from sleep paralysis do, in fact, report that they felt they were sexually violated by an invading entity. Now, as soon as a person wakes up completely, the entity vanishes. And most people selectively forget, you know, those types of unpleasant encounters, especially of sexual violation, or the sometimes accompanying preoccupation with the fact of human mortality. Now, that's the overriding reality of the eventuality of death is often, you know, a striking and marked, you know, component of sleep paralysis. You know, by now it should be pretty clear that sleep paralysis is just the modern name medical science gives to medieval reports. You know, what medieval reports talked about a sexual assault by demons known as, you know, succubi and incubi. Those reports, we can find them in Jewish and Christian lore. And they're related to ancient Jewish legends that ultimately go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 6. Now, this popular story of the so-called sons of God, that is the angels who descended to earth and made into human daughters, and the offspring of these humans, according to the tale, were half divine and half human, no? Half angelic, half human. And Genesis 6 is arguably an abridgment of a fuller and more original account found in the Ethiopic Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch, chapter 1, verse 9, of that particular work is actually quoted in the New Testament Epistle of Jude in verse 14. The account in Genesis chapter 6, and coincidentally also in the book of Enoch chapter 6, it continues by narrating that the offspring of the angels and the human women were giants, now, who began to threaten the very existence of humanity on earth. So the angelic fathers were therefore punished by being bound in chains under the earth. The parallel to the Greek myth of the Titans is pretty clear. But it's not that Genesis borrowed from Greek myth, but it's that both the Genesis and the Greek myth represent independent versions of an ancient Near Eastern story. That's pretty clear from the evidence. Now, the so-called bastard offspring, according to Genesis, were destroyed in the great deluge in the time of Noah. But the flood only destroyed their bodies, according to the legend. Now, the spirits of these destroyed bodies are free to roam the earth till the end of time to torment and possess humans. Since human women willingly united sexually with the angels in the first place, and that's what gave these angels sort of legal right to bother humans till the judgment day, you know, to what Judaism and Christianity consider the end of time. So since these disembodied spirits once inhabited bodies, they experienced the tormenting memory of passion, hunger, thirst, you know, fill in the blanks there. They therefore seek to find new bodies, you know, to inhabit in a process known popularly as traditionally for demonic possession. So the demons are not in these myths, you know, in the Torah and the book of Genesis and in the book of Enoch and in the Gospels. The demons are not fallen angels. They are the half-angelic, half-human, disembodied spirits of the children of the fallen angels. In a nutshell, that was the dominant Jewish belief at the time, you know, when Christianity arose. And the same belief you know, can be documented in ancient Jewish writings from the time of the New Testament and in the New Testament itself. So, you know, that, for instance, in a nutshell, was the belief of probably the historical Jesus. But the sexual nature of the encounters between humans and demons in medieval Jewish and Christian literature continues the theme of the more ancient accounts that I just talked to you about. But And it was often believed that certain women actually had children whose fathers were demons, you know, in medieval times. That belief was still there. And in modern times, a lot of medical experts believe that these unpleasant medieval experiences are also equivalent to the modern phenomenon of sexual invasion through medical probes by supposed extraterrestrials, during what's popularly known as abduction experiences. That you were talking about earlier. Abductees are also known to claim that certain of their children are the product of alien fathers. So what were formerly called demons and angels in the ancient medieval period are now called, in an age of science and science fiction, extraterrestrials. It makes a lot of sense folklorically, you know. But now the fact that medical science has created a label for the medieval experience of succubi and incubi, assault or impregnation, and modern alien abduction, in my opinion, by no means explains, let alone explains away, the experiences themselves. You know, just as saying that, let's say, in Norse mythology, the god of thunder, Thor, if you say, well, that's a personification of natural thunder, that doesn't resolve the underlying question of whether or not the forces of nature are themselves manifestations of, let's say, transcendent realities or something of that order. You know, modern scientists tend to scoff at the idea, but Native American tribes and the world's Aboriginal peoples, you know, would beg to differ. In any event, the fact remains that I remember a personal, memory just came to me. A friend of mine who is a Hindu, is a medical doctor. We were talking into the wee hours of the morning. I had mentioned that, you know, just the mere application of a scientific label, you know, sleep paralysis, it doesn't answer the question of whether or not some quote-unquote paranormal process might lie behind, you know, the entity's experience in the phenomenon known as sleep paralysis. Anyway, fortunately, most sufferers from sleep paralysis cease having those unpleasant experiences by their late 20s, and most deliberately forget they ever had those types of disturbing encounters. And that forgetfulness can be explained, of course, by Freudian psychology. But anyway, some have been known to consciously crave and even nurture the remembrance of the entities that visited them in the prime of their young adult years. They want them to return, and sometimes they even want to have sexual relationships of an ongoing nature with them. But anyway, medical science knows the precise region of the brain to stimulate in order to artificially induce sleep paralysis and the perception of assaulting, threatening entities. Still, the knowledge of the material locus, you know, of the brain where the experience manifests itself physically doesn't tell us everything about the ultimate and possibly non-physical or psychological origins of the reality. Questions still remain, at least for me, because we're dealing here with a question relating to not only the subject of the human mind, but the very question of what is the fabric of reality. Now, instead of talking about glitches in time or time glitches, I would rather talk about reality glitches.
Very interesting. And of course, you know, that gets a good bit into the not just the actual experience, but also the interpretations of people's different experiences. And as the experiencer, our anonymous experiencer there recounted, often there does seem to be a sort of a prevailing evil underlying the experience of sleep paralysis. Now, one of our listeners, Daniel, wrote to me a while ago about a personal experience that he had with sleep paralysis just as well. And this I found just to be incredible. He and I had corresponded a good bit about this, and he'd mentioned that he'd had a very strange paranormal experience. And I told him if he would like to share it, that he could write me directly here on the show, and we would talk about that. And sure enough, he did. This is the experience that he shared with me, and it remains probably one of the more strange experiences that I've ever had recounted to me involving one's personal interpretation of a sleep paralysis experience. It all happened 1 year ago. It seemed just like yet another episode of sleep paralysis. I woke up and immediately realized that my body was completely paralyzed, just as usual. I tried to relax, as I usually do, and to go back to sleep, but something really weird happened at that point. Three entities, Daniel writes, just materialized in front of me out of thin air. Well, two of them had no distinguishable features, but the remaining one was terribly creepy. It had the most terrorizing white eyes I had ever seen, short white hair and a wrinkled face. Anyway, this thing just climbed up onto the bed, sat down right on my chest, while the other two beings that accompanied it, they resembled, I guess, what you might call shadow people, they seized my arms and held me down by the hands. Now, the third being, this wraith, if you will, had its knees on my chest, which made breathing for me almost impossible. And all of a sudden it bent down and started to whisper things in my ear. I can't really recall everything it told me, but I do recall that it kept telling me that praying would not really save me at that moment, which is a funny thing because I'm an atheist, Daniel writes. Now, at some point it also tried to kiss me. It tried to make out with me. Well, after I convinced myself that the entity present in my room was not a product of my mere imagination, I started to struggle at this point to try and free myself of whatever was attacking me. And then I finally did manage to break out of the paralysis completely, and I was able to get up. And as I did that, I watched the three entities. They just walked out through the door, which blasted wide open. Now, obviously, I was still a bit overwhelmed and grasping for air. I checked the clock and noticed that it was around 6 a.m. in the morning, and for whatever reason, I decided to open my curtains, thinking that the ordeal may finally be over. However, when I opened them, then I saw three little blue orbs of light, and I immediately passed out. 3 hours later, I woke up right there where I'd fallen on the floor. When I got out of my room, my brother, who was there with me in the apartment, He was still sitting in front of his computer playing games. Anyway, the first thing he told me was, "Did you see that shadow that came out of your room?" Well, several incidents happened after this little incident, including a fire that broke out in my apartment, among some other weird events. And that's basically it. There's more to it, though, in this case. Really, this was really my first encounter with this entity. So Daniel went on to allude that essentially this was one of many encounters, ongoing encounters throughout his life that he had had with this strange being, this entity, this wraith-like, this demonic character. It was very strange. Although I wouldn't say that every single incident that occurs with people where they have felt that there was some sort of an extra normal or a paranormal experience during the sleep paralysis episode, they aren't all bad. That, you know, it would be to mischaracterize the phenomenon, especially its more subjective elements, to say that every incidence of sleep paralysis is entirely bad. For instance, there was the author, Louis Proud, he's an Australian who wrote a book called Dark Intrusions, many years ago, that dealt with the paranormal nature of sleep paralysis and the sleep paralysis experience. And Louis talked about many incidents, and he spoke very frankly about this in the book, that were sexual encounters that he had with strange beings that would occur during the sleep paralysis experience. But the thing is, and this is what's interesting about it, if you are actually able to engage in a sexual experience with an entity in bed at night, I would have to assume that you're not entirely paralyzed, right? You would have to be able to move to some extent. And Louis even talked about a couple of experiences with one little entity that he said was kind of like this entity almost had a childlike, capacity. There was something about it that was almost childlike. And he said that this little creature would just want to snuggle up to him and just hold on to him while he lay there and sleep, which is really strange. And I reviewed the book, and after a while, Louis had contacted me, and he said, "Now, let me guess, you're someone who's more of a skeptic. You don't think there's anything paranormal about these experiences." I'll say this. In my own experiences with sleep paralysis, I have not found that it is, to me, anything that I would liken to being paranormal. But, you know, for me, I think it's clearly psychological, and I'm aware that I'm dreaming as I'm dreaming and experiencing that, which in a sense, Caleb, that could be in its sense a lucid dream, in the sense that at very least, although I am dreaming, I am aware of the fact that I'm dreaming and cognizant of the fact that what I'm experiencing are hallucinatory elements of the dream state.
Well, it's really interesting to me exactly how the mind can fake itself out into feeling actual physical interpretations of things that are obviously not real. I can remember just recently, a few nights ago, had a very realistic lucid dream about being on a beach, and I remember so vividly walking on that beach and feeling the hot sand beneath my feet and thinking how, after the fact when I'd woken up, thinking how incredible it was that I'd felt something so intense and so real. And going back to that last story that you told, it makes me wonder, because in my experience that I'd talked about previously, where I had encountered in a kind of awake, asleep, but still mobilized time, I saw the birds underneath the bed sheets, and I could literally see them moving underneath the sheet, but I was up and I was moving and leaving. I wasn't paralyzed at all. It reminds me of how he gets up and sees these blue orbs leaving the window, but, you know, who's to say that it wasn't some sort of, if this could be the case, paranormal influence, so to speak, because as you said, his brother saw a shadow person or a shadow leaving the room. It makes you wonder, are these, in certain cases, paranormally influenced by some sort of negative vortexical energy that is in these places, you know? Right. And I'm not saying that that's what it is, but you have to take into consideration there are places on Earth that have weird energies.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, if you've ever been to Gettysburg or if you've ever been to Auschwitz, you would certainly feel that way. And who knows what the actual underlying cause for these experiences are. I have had anecdotal references that people, experiencers of sleep paralysis, have shared with me, where they've talked about, you know, having seen entities and seen such things after the fact as footprints outside their door that seem to be indicative of an actual physical presence, objects moved and things that seem to indicate that there had been an interaction with the environment, which again, to me, kind of brings things back around to the notion of there being this often what appears to be a negative presence throughout the experience. I don't know what to make of an experience that someone has where they claimed that they were an atheist, okay, and yet they had a wraith-like entity sitting on top of them, making out with them, saying, praying won't help you now. I mean, is there some sort of an archetypal level of understanding that occurs during the dreamlike sleep paralysis experience, during which the experiencer experiences multiple levels of myth and culture that may not even be innate to the beliefs of the individual? Or is there a genuinely, potentially dangerous and very evil phenomenon that is occurring here?
I don't know exactly what it makes about, or what about the nature of this experience makes us kind of mentally steer towards the negative. But I think that in the majority of the cases that people are experiencing sleep paralysis, when the negative nature manifests itself as some sort of demon, it usually takes some form of some either demonic, some people it's like The Exorcist or something, and I've heard many people say on occasions that there was some sort of a giant looming demon, sometimes like armor clad. Don't know what it is about the negative aspect that takes, but it always seems to take the form of some sort of monster. So it might be this archetypal idea of the evil or negativity in our maybe childhood psyche has to take some form of a monster for us to interpret it.
Right. So the sociologist perspective, Tyler Pittman, you know, with your training in sociology and you also coming from an experience that, you know, was frightening enough to where you aren't comfortable even talking about it on the microphone. Is there an actual evil element, or is there a, from culture to culture, an interpretation of maybe a literal, well, I mean, what could be likened to the cultural boogeyman that manifests in that dream state? Why is there such a negativity, I wonder?
To answer your question, I think it would be more of the latter. Each culture interprets this concept of evil. I would imagine that it's a concept shared globally. Now, evil in itself it's definitely subjective. What we think of as a boogeyman, it's kind of like manifesting and creating this almost like a totem. I'm sure it takes different forms throughout all the cultures of the globe. But an interesting thing would be to look at some of the cases globally and see kind of how it's been interpreted. I'm sure the science is still young on that, really, with this whole, even the whole idea of sleep paralysis being given a name. Sure, as a classification, it's something we can speculate upon right now, but as far as finding firm footing, let's not trouble ourselves and have nightmares over it.
Somebody's going to, though. That seems to be the thing. Somebody out there, someone is waking from that horrific dream, and they're troubled by it, and they're going to continue to ask those kinds of questions, just like we do here. Thank you for enduring another hour with us discussing the mysteries of sleep paralysis. I'm Micah Hanks, joined by Tyler Pittman and Caleb Hanks. Caleb, sweet dreams. Yeah! And on behalf of all of us here at Grailian International, Dick Oakley, Tyler Pittman, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. We are the Grailian Gang, keeping you company every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. We'll talk to you next week, and until then, my friends, as always, stay strange.
Broadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grailian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GrailianReport.com.